This is RV on Business.
Welcome to 101.9 Chai FM. It's 6 minutes past 11. Thank you so much for joining us. That season is here. It's finally arrived, and there's nothing you can do about it except for actually just get with the story, get with the program, and get it done. The truth is that I'm talking about tax season. It is so much simpler in South Africa than in so many other parts of the world. I'm sure a lot of you will be raising your eyebrows because nothing in South Africa can be better than any other parts of the world. Nothing could be further from the truth. There are many things that are far better. And one of them is paying your taxes. SARS has really grown, has developed, is one of those branches of government that, besides a short lull in their really professional life from the beginning and the onset of democracy, has really taken us into a next level. And the way SARS works, if you are a straightforward individual who simply works in a job, gets an IRP5, has a few medical aid deductions, and life is not too complicated, you have a pension, you've got a retirement annuity, SARS already knows about that. It's already there. You just need to go on and confirm it, and you're done. And the truth is, if it's all done correctly and you're on top of your stuff, you don't have to be really too au fait with what's going on. You just need to have a sort of a helicopter idea of how things work. You need to do things on time. And the truth is that I remember even in the late 80s, early 90s in university, the tax lecturer saying, SARS is fair. If you treat SARS fairly, he will treat you fairly. You get your stuff in on time, you get things in a way that is acceptable and recognizable, you will get things back quickly and efficiently. Some of us have had different experiences, but that's the way it usually works. Anyway, Andre from TaxTim, thank you so much for joining us. Did I say anything out of line?
I must be honest, I think you were very articulate. I'm surprised that that people have a live read. That people have a this view of this more positive view of SARS. It's something that I am fairly proud of as a tax practitioner. Of I've been doing this for 17 years. A lot of people, and this is something I've seen on financial media, which is on financial media, which almost makes SARS look like they're the devil, or they're evil, or they're stealing from taxpayers, and it's this assumption. And then I learned this early in my career with one of my tax partners, a prior tax partner, said it causes an ostrich head in the sand situation, where instead of dealing with SARS or getting help from a practitioner, you become avoidant about tax. And you're 100% right. I think it was American. A lot of Americans find that compared to the South African version of filing it, it's like filing in South Africa is a breeze. But I think it's both the technological marvel of e-filing and that story, and also the fact that we've got an interesting legal system, which is obviously it's there's a mix between the Roman Dutch law and common law principles, and our legal the tax legal system is so robust. I do think that in recent years, SARS have improved the communications. They have become more technological. Especially, there was an era when things could have gone a bit wrong, which was when Tomo Yane was at SARS. But since Keith Stritter moved on from there, or took over from, basically the institution got a much better reputation.
Andre, we need to take a quick break and run to the shops. As you can see, Craig's telling us there. Let's take a quick break and we'll continue with that thought when we come back.
This is RV on Business.
Welcome back to 101.9 High FM. It is 12 minutes past 11. Andre from Taxton, we were saying just before the break, you brought up an interesting comparison between tax in America and tax in South Africa. And not to steal your thunder, but a lot of my friends over here are Americans. And I have family that are married to Americans. And just correct me if I'm wrong, but the American tax system works on this idea of worldwide wealth and worldwide income. So if you are an American, the American tax authorities want to know where all your assets are, no matter where they are in the world, and what you're earning, no matter where you are earning it in the world. And, you know, it obviously comes out in the wash, but it is a really broad reporting program that South Africans have very differently. In South Africa, you can become a non-tax resident. You can keep your passport, keep your ID. You can own property in South Africa. But if you don't live there and earn there, you don't need to pay tax there, which just makes life so much easier. Andre, any mistakes in that?
Yeah, I think whilst you're a South African tax resident and you haven't, you have not yet become a non-resident or follow through with that process, you are also taxed on your worldwide income. Yes. But the break from being a South African resident or tax resident, so becoming a non-resident, SARS, you know, they say if you still have South African source income, that must be reported. And I think you're correct in that the IRS still wants you to report, to have some sort of reporting, even if you become a non-resident from an IRS perspective. I know that from, I've had this client for a very long time in the past, and he's American, and he still needs to do some sort of reporting, even though he's been in South Africa for years. So yeah, there is a bit of a divulge between the two.
Let's get into the press release that you guys put out, because there were some very, very nice pieces of information there that are important. So the first thing is, as we're talking and bragging about SARS auto assessments, how do those work? What are they all about? Or is that the South African government's spying on absolutely everything I do, and let the conspiracy theories roll?
I mean, the conspiracy theories are conspiracies. Anyway, so let's start with the basics. So auto assessment is really just it's a third-party data pool from the main things that people do. So if you're employed, if you have a medical aid, if you have a retirement annuity, the standard financial activity that the average South African might have, those data, your RP5, your medical aid, your RA, gets pulled from SARS. And they've been building that third-party information system for probably for as long as I've been in tax, so 17 plus years. Anyway, so they use that third-party data to then come up with an estimated assessment. Granted that you don't have anything else that you need to declare, other income and other deductions, that assessment is fairly accurate. SARS wants to claim and say, no, but it's 100% accurate. But I disagree. There can sometimes be spanners in the works, but that's basically what an auto assessment is.
And you've really given a nice list of common items that might be missing. So, for example, freelance, side hustle, or other self-employment income. Mm-hmm. That's based on the premise that you're honest enough to declare it and you're putting it down as income. Rental income, because again, that might be going into a separate account and might be under a company name, whatever. Foreign income, Section 18A donations. Now, again, this is an interesting thing, Andre, that I picked up living overseas. South Africans are big philanthropists. They give generously. But South Africans also give from their car window a lot. They give at the parking lot a lot. And this idea that I give a lot of charity. I remember clearly hearing many, many years ago, one of our top cricketers, his name just escapes me, said that he has a thing, him and his wife, at the beginning of the month, they cash X amount of rands into 2 rand coins. They put it each in their cars. And when it's finished, it's finished. They've done that part of their charity, because it came up that it's never ending. And he was just saying there is a way to manage it and to control it. But where our South Africans are often not on top of it when it comes to 18A donations. Andre, can you just unpack that a little bit for our listeners so they understand what it means to make an 18A donation and how it impacts the tax?
So 18A donations are a very specific type of donation. It's not even just the money that you give to a church, for example. So 18A donations are that there's specific organizations. It might be MSF or Doctors Without Borders. These are specific organizations that's registered as a registered public benefit organization. And when you give them money, you have to basically get a certificate called the Section 18A certificate with their MPO number on, PPO number, and all those things. And let's say you earn 500,000 rand a year. You can then get you donate up to 10%, so 50,000. Then that 50,000 is a deduction. So you're going to only pay tax on 950, the difference between the two.
It works very similarly to a retirement annuity or a pension would, that it actually lowers your income. By the way, for those of you who are listening, Taxtim is there. Please go look it up. I've been interviewing them for years. It is one of the hall brands of South African tax and financial management. Big insurance companies recommend that their clients use them. There are no longer excuses. They're also not a faceless website. You can always speak to a human being, but get your taxes in line. You will feel like a different person, and you will feel so empowered once it's done and it's off your case. Andre, we need to run back to the shops, but I want to carry on with this list when we come back in a moment.
This is RV on Business.
Welcome back to 101.9 Chai FM. It is 21 minutes past 11. Well, we're now going back to Andre at Taxtim, and we just discussed how you can reduce paying tax by giving donations. So please just remember, as Andre pointed out, that they are very specific. You need to ask them if they are tax deductible. Often a lot of our religious institutions that are very important to us, like our churches, our synagogues, are not necessarily tax deductible because they don't reach the criteria. However, sister organizations may be, feeding schemes, education schemes. So please ask and please look into that. The next thing you have here is qualifying out-of-pocket medical expenses. Please break that down for us.
Okay, so the qualifying out-of-pocket medical expenses are your doctor fees from a registered medical practitioner, or it is scripts that they any pharmacy scripts that they've issued. So it's not your standard over the counter pharmacy things. And then so that's one part. But the second part that makes medical aid a bit more worth claiming, I would say, is if you are over 65, or you have a member in the family who have a registered disability, you can claim more. There will be more qualifying medical expenses that they can qualify for, and both the 65 year old or that disability category allows you to claim a higher medical credit compared to people who are below 65 or don't have a member, a household member with a medical disability. But with those extra claims, you have to have a lot more supporting documents to put together. And so traditionally medical aid, is often not a great claim. It used to be amazing when medical was in a deduction form compared to the credit form that it currently is in.
Andre, someone's just mentioned here a really good point. Just quickly reading it, but let me just summarize the point because I read it while you were giving the explanation there. The point is that often you know, for example, that your savings are depleted on a medical aid. It's still worthwhile to try put it through the medical aid, even though you know it's going to be deducted. Why? Because then the medical aid will give you a list of everything that they didn't pay. And there's your paper trail. Instead of having to keep every slip, every piece of paper, put everything through the medical aid. A rejection is not like getting your credit card declined. It's you knew it was going to happen, but it's a way of just keeping a paper trail.
Yeah, I think that's a very good habit to fall into. So if you belong to a medical aid and your MSA is depleted, it will be that additional expenses that it will actually show on the medical aid certificate, and SARS will pull it through as part of the third party data. And it means that usually SARS is perfectly happy with that additional medical expenses without needing to provide any additional. So it's the additional medical expenses that's not on your medical aid that you often have to go through more effort to support the claim.
Andre, you would have thought that we cursed somebody's mother because the lines have gone ballistic. I just want to separate out. There's a lot of confusion out there. We'll do a whole different show, and I don't want to take up Andre's time on this, but over-the-counter medication, things like Panado, Grandpa, I don't know, paracetamol, things like that, Rennies, don't put through your medical aid. It's insanity because it just wipes out your savings, pushes your self-payment gap up. It does chaos like that, and you're not going to be able to claim those things. So that's really, but it's small money. What we're talking about is when you've run out of your MSA, your medical savings account, and the medicine is not on chronic, then put it through so you've got a paper trail. But we'll do a whole show on that and we'll get up there. But please don't get confused about that. And I have said many times not to buy silly medicine over the counter and put it through your medical aid because it plays havoc with the savings and the self-payment gap. The next one that comes up is, I think, something that we could have a whole show on, and that's home office expenses. I just want to preface it by saying, for all the years that I had a home office, I was so grateful that I had built the home and that I had plans and that my architect actually told me what the surface percentage was or the area percentage where I worked from. And when I said, yeah, but I sit in the lounge or I walk to the bathroom, he said, your office and the guest toilet, that's it. The rest is just pushing it. Don't go there. And again, that's where SARS is fair. If you're going to claim it, prove that you have it. And once you've done that, you move on. Andre, flesh that out for us a little bit.
So the home office claim has been needle for SARS, and I think when COVID happened, it really helped. You know, I don't mean to praise COVID here at all, but it helped to solidify people's understanding of what it is. So these four walls is a home office, right? Your living room is not a home office. So it's specific that the home office is defined as it's a space that is it's actually exclusively for office use. So even if it's a bedroom, if it's primarily used as a bedroom, it will be disqualified. Now, that being said, okay, and that's the first rule. So exclusive use and four walls. The second second one is the rule that says mainly. You mainly have to work from home in order to qualify. The word mainly means more than 50%. So if you have a hybrid setup and your employer allows you to work from home, it means that most of the time you should be working from home. Other days you can be in the office, then you can qualify for the home office claim. Prior to COVID, people used to be able to claim their interest, a portion of their interest on as part of a home office claim. But then after the whole COVID debacle, SARS confirmed that as far as I can remember, it was a special type of 12J, I can't remember off the top of my head, where interest on a bond is not part of the home office claim and only rental. So if you're renting, you can deduct a portion of rent, but you don't get a portion of interest as a deduction as part of the home office claim. And that ruined actually the home office claim for a lot of people, because the effort, and Keith Engel, the CEO from SAT, you know, our the professional body for practitioners, he said the moment SARS has to go through more effort to allow a claim, the same amount of effort has to apply for the individual. So if you have to claim for home office, there's an effort on SARS side to allow it. And so the effort to claim for home office compared to the tax outcome is often way lopsided. It's a lot of effort to claim for home office, and that's why Keith, you know, he said it's actually a lousy deduction, in his words.
So yeah, one's got to be very careful about it, and especially getting this idea of where do you work. Let's say commission earners who have an office, their argument might be, yes, I do go to the office, I'm there in the morning, speak to the staff, I'm on the road a lot, but I don't go back to the office after 3-4 o'clock in the afternoon. And I sit at that desk until the wee hours of the morning working. So it's a very tricky one. The last two that I want to go through is, the other one is business travel against travel allowances. Does that really mainly apply to people who travel, lay out money, and then claim it back?
So the business travel as part of travel allowance is where the company pays a portion of your salary, not as a salary, but as a travel allowance, and then you keep a logbook. Now, the frustrating part, and I've seen this before, is some companies will just do the travel allowance even if you don't travel for work, and that frustrates me to no end, because this gets a bit technical, but when you have travel allowance, you only have to apply 80% of that travel allowance as pay as you earn on it, not the full 100%. So that's a technicality. But if you do travel for work, and travel for work, a lot of people get confused with this. They think it's traveling from home to the office and back. It's not. Travel for work is basically travel to a client or to a site that is away from the office or away from your home office. So it's the travel in addition to the travel that's necessary for you just to get to work. Now, if you work at different sites, or if you're, for example, a property, you're an estate agent, or you sell cars, or you sell financial services, you obviously travel a lot more, but they are paid on a commission basis. And so their travel deduction is calculated differently compared to a normal travel allowance deduction.
Okay, so that really puts it into perspective. And then there's the last one. You've got some interesting wording here. Direct retirement annuity contributions not reported by a fund. How or when would there be a scenario when those contributions are not reported? Wouldn't then all be on your tax certificate?
So the RA captures, so the RA certificate captures, I would say 95%. I think that extra wording is on the odd chance, and this doesn't happen often. Let's say you've got a pension at work, but then you make a voluntary additional pension contribution, but it doesn't go through your payroll, and now you can declare it in addition to the RA deduction, But it's separate. But, you know, I've been doing this for a very long time. I haven't seen that come up very often, because most of the time they tell their employer, hey, I want to do an increased pension contribution. And then the employer adds it to your RP5, and so it will pull through. So I would say in most circumstances, your any additional contribution will either pull through the correct source code on your RP5 or on the certificate from the retirement annuity fund.
Andreas, always we're running out of time when we can sit and talk. It's just so easy to talk to you about seeming such a complex topic. But let's just go to the end of the story. A person's now on SARS e-filing. Mm-hmm. They've done everything. They've used your calculator. And they look at everything, and everything just seems fine. How long does it take for SARS to finalize things, get back to them? What's the process?
So if you've submitted your return, if you've got your auto assessment, and you want to file a correction, or you want to file the extra things before the 23rd of October, and now they ask for the documents that you have to submit, supporting documents, there's generally a 21 working day period, so a normal month, that they have to send you a completion letter or ask for additional info. So I would say if everything is fine, usually you get your refund within 3 to 5 working days and it gets paid automatically. That's the case with many taxpayers. Then there's the first check for supporting documents. There's about a month that goes by. And then if there's an additional check, about 2 months. So I would say from the point of submitting your return or making correction on e-filing to actually that all being sorted, I usually put that in a 3-month window in most cases. You have extraneous circumstances where you're filing a lot of historical returns or fixing stuff, or you've got an objection. Those things can take up to 6 months to 12 months. But, you know, you can guarantee that, you know, once taxes, I like to say that tax is one of those things, and auto assessments, it's like one of those things that you do once a year, right? You do your car license once a year. You take your car for a service once a year. It's one of those things that should be on the average South African's list of annual things to do, right? And you just tick it off. I've got ADHD, so I don't even have a list like that, but it's good to know.
Yeah, and there you're absolutely right. And even for those of us who have the similar diagnosis as you, tax e-filing makes it so much easier, and it's there. We've already got 2 minutes, and some questions just come through now. Do I need to keep my credit card slips, or is my credit card statement good enough?
Oh, this is a can of worms, and I'll try and answer it in 2 minutes. So, I default, and I'm talking from a perspective as the tax practitioner, I default to telling people they can use their bank statements as proof that they've paid for something. Okay. The reason why is because that is the same that's used to produce financial statements for a company. But SARS can get really pedantic about claiming on expenses for commission, for example. And they can often ask for invoices and proof of payment. However, a bank statement is a form of proof of payment. So my rule of thumb is if you did pay for something, that item, if it's more than 2,000 rand, please keep the invoice. If it's below 2,000 rand, but again, you know, when it comes to that bank statement fight, the credit card statement, It actually depends, and I hate this answer because a lot of practitioners give it, but in this case, it does depend on your situation.
So just to end off, Andre, what I've often found is if you have one of those little crocodile clips in your car, you put all your petrol statements in there, keep them all together in the cubbyhole, have a wallet that you take every piece of paper, fold it up and put it in the back, And once a week on a Saturday, you just empty it and try empty it into a bag with a month on it so that you can keep things neat and tidy. If you have to go back to it, at least you know you've got something and you can try find it. Just to put it into a drawer, you're going to have to pay some student a lot of money to separate that out for you. But, you know, text them is available for you. And just text, just to give out the details, you can send a message, a WhatsApp message or a voice note to South Africa 69030 8700. Again, that's 069030 8700. Or you can just go on to textim, textim.com, and you've got everything there at your fingerprints, fingertips at least. You don't need to be anxious. You don't need to duck and dive. Just get it done. And what you're going to pay for the service is going to be a fraction of what you'll pay for either therapy or fines. So just get it done and get it sorted out. Andre, thank you so much for chatting to us. And yeah, tax is always a prickly subject, but we had, I think, a lot of fun. Thank you so much.
Thanks for the conversation, Avi. Have a good day.
Great, thank you. Let's take a quick break. We'll be back right after this.
This is RV on Business.
Welcome back to 101.9 High FM. It's 18 minutes to 12. And just to let you know, I just want to take the next few minutes to maybe just highlight two major events that I've been part of in the last 2 weeks or so. The first was an incredible experience that I had to be invited by Wizo South Africa, or Wizo Cape Town more particularly, to go down to Cape Town to speak to their members. I flew down on Friday morning, not last week, the week before. I spoke in someone's home in Stellenbosch. I then spoke in a Marais Road shul on Shabbos morning, on Shabbat morning. And then again on Motzei Shabbat in the coffee shop down the road in Sea Point at Starbucks. And then the main event was a Sunday afternoon. What I got exposed to was something that I knew that existed, but had no idea about the scope, the intensity, or the commitment. And here I'm talking about Christian Zionists. As South Africans, we were all exposed to some form of Christian Zionism by the silver star with the green piece of felt underneath it that so many people that we came into contact with on a daily basis wore. And it was a sign of a religious person, a sign of somebody who had deep ethics and morals. But I'm talking about something else here. I'm talking about primarily white South Africans. And I think that is maybe important to mention that also the majority of them are Afrikaans speaking, and they are huge supporters of Israel. They are deep Christians. They are people of faith. They are people who live their religion, and they are people with boundless acceptance, boundless love, boundless commitment to Israel, in the most profound ways. You know, I was speaking to a particular rabbi who said to me that after the 7th of October, he really wanted to get a solidarity tour to Israel as quickly as possible. And he really battled. People were nervous. People were anxious. And as an Israeli, as somebody who lived through that, I can appreciate it to some extent. He said, on the other hand, the Christians didn't hesitate. They were there. The moment they could get on the flight, no matter how they could get there, they got there. And their purpose of getting to Israel was to help, was to give of their time, to give of their expertise. And so many of them came over with suitcases full of letters just to hand out, whether it was to soldiers, whether it was to survivors, whether it's to people who had been through trauma, just to say that there are people of maybe a different religion, who love you, who care about you, and are coming out to say that so clearly and in such a clear way. The other thing that strikes me about what goes on with the Christians in Cape Town is that every Friday outside Parliament, there's an anti-Israel demonstration. It is almost ignored by people because it's been going on for so long. I suppose in a macabre way, you have to doff your hat at those who stand there with their religious fervor and stand and curse Israel. Jews don't go. And they've been told not to go. There have been altercations. There have been confrontations. It's been unpleasant. Jews, on the whole, have chosen to ignore it, not to turn a blind eye as such or have an ostrich syndrome, but rather to say that it's a freedom of speech. People can say what they want, even what they're saying is vulgar and blatantly dishonest and disingenuous. But standing on the other side are Christians, Christians of every color and creed, Christians who stand there. One particular gentleman, his name is Adam, that I met, stands there. He's been gifted with a beautiful voice. And he says he just stands there and sings, whether it's Christian songs, whether it's Israeli songs, whether it's songs that he's heard in shul. He stands there and he sings. In my assessment, these people are people that I look up to, admire, respect, have unlimited amount of time for, because they don't only go to Israel to be seen that day there. That's the last thing on their agenda. They go to help. They bring money. They bring equipment, whatever is needed. They volunteer. They are seen. They are totally non-violent. They are totally non-vulgar. I must have met 300-400 Christian people, leaders, religious leaders, and lay leaders, and community members. There's no vulgarity. There's no hate. There's no revenge. They don't talk about going and doing anything negative. It's all about positive. And as a Jew myself, and someone who grew up in the Johannesburg bubble, I've been exposed to people of many religions over my life, thank God. But I'm not comfortable, so to speak, with having religious conversations with people of other religions. And I suppose that's my own insecurity, with the understanding that maybe I need to be really comfortable and au fait with all the different various levels and gradations of Jewish understanding before I start trying to understand other things. I was never made to feel uncomfortable. I was never challenged. I was never put on the spot where I had to justify that I am Jewish. All I had to do was show a huge amount of humility to people who welcomed me into their homes, who welcomed me into their groups, who listened to what I had to say with empathy and understanding. And to say that there were people who came to the talks who are suffering in their own different way, and apparently who got solace from different things that I said by speaking personally and openly, that is what humanity is all about. And I'm proud and I'm honored to be a friend of Elizabeth, who organized this, someone who I met here in Israel, who I've been to our vineyard with. And I'm proud that I was given the opportunity to be able to share our story as a family, and also as a South African family and as a member of the South African community, just to touch base with people who care so much about us in so many ways. Let's take a quick break before Craig gets angry, and I'll be back with you in a moment.
This is RV on Business.
Welcome back to 101.9 Chai FM. It is 8 minutes to 12, but it actually gives me 5 or 6 minutes to speak. Yesterday, I took the manager of the farm where our vineyard is, together with all the young people who work on the farm and certain of the farm managers. And these are people with a lot of experience, you know, either in the Air Force or in construction or in agriculture. They've just been around for a long time. And the young people are people either straight out of the army or people who are doing their community service over there. And we were given the opportunity to go under the Kotel Plaza, which is now the Kotel Plaza platform. So if you're standing facing the Kotel and the Israeli flag is in front of you, that area from the Israeli flag all the way behind to the new building, that is now a platform. And we were taken underground and we were shown the latest excavations that are happening. And we were showing different things that were found and how civilization, so to speak, from one era to another are built on top of each other, and where the first temple era was and how then the second temple era was built, and how after the second temple, how the Romans destroyed things. And we were walking on a mosaic road, a road made out of small mosaic stone. And it was explained to us that after the Jerusalem was destroyed by the Romans and they plowed it up and then renamed it Capitola, Jews were not allowed to walk on those roads. And, you know, it was ironic. It has young people of a new generation standing there. But the highlight of what we really experienced was finding certain artifacts about tithes, a certain ring that you would put around crop in order to say this is a tithe, not as a religious tithe, but as a tax. And then they were, you know, with certain stamps that were used by the priests, the Levites, and the general population for different things. And we were shown all of that. What really touched us is that we were shown a ritual bath, what we would refer to as a mikveh. And this mikveh was from the Second Temple era. And the guide, whose name is Dov, he's the deputy CEO of the Kotel Foundation, and did it out of his own, you know, free time in memory of our son Eli. He showed us this mikveh, this ritual bath, and he said a bath this size to excavate, to take all the sand out and to go through it with a paintbrush so finely should take 3 to 4 weeks. He says we emptied it out in a day. Why? Because the Romans wanted to cover up any symbol or vestige of Jewish existence in this area. And they used the thing that they had at their fingertips, which was ash. They used the ash that was left after the destruction of the temple, and they shoved it into this ritual bath. And then he turned around to the one young lady and said, you mentioned to me that you're getting married shortly. She said, yes. He says, do you have the custom that the groom puts a little bit of ash on his forehead to remember the destruction of the temple? And she said, yes. And he pulled out a little Ziploc money bag and he gave it to her as a gift. And he said, your bride-to-be, your groom-to-be, can put the actual ashes of the temple on his forehead before he gets married. And he wished her a joyful marriage, wedding, and a happy life together. And we all stood there looking at each other. People from all different walks of life, people who maybe society judges differently when they look at us. And we all stood there with tears in our eyes, knowing that from the destruction, from the cover-up of the destruction that Jews ever lived there, this groom is going to prove to us that he is going to get married in our holy land according to our laws and customs. And he's going to bring up his family together with his special young bride that I did the tour with tomorrow. And they will be the next generation. And she said, as someone who I didn't expect to hear this from, that please God, we won't use these ashes because the Messiah will come before that. And then we won't remember the destruction. We will just remember the good time that we have going forward. With that, I leave you. Craig, as always, thank you so much for keeping me in line. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Have a great week. Speak to you later.